everyone. Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage.
And Candace, it's been so great catching up with you. In our pre-show chat, we caught up on the X-Files and politic things, and yeah, it was nice.
All the things. All the important things
All the
in
important
life.
Things. Now we just have to record this show.
Yeah.
End Credits is your local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Thursday at 10 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week is the new romantic drama Call Me By Your Name. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some recent news items, and this week that includes copyright news. Oh yeah, copyright news. A number of copyrights from 1923 are set to expire next year, and we'll dig into the contentious and highly partisan issues those present. And then we'll dig into politics a bit more by talking about the possibility of a Fire and Fury TV miniseries, which is weird because I already thought the Trump administration was like a TV show.
Oh, that was my line.
That's what you get for missing pre-production meetings. And... But first, theater attendance was down last year. They've just come out with the all the numbers for, or the final numbers, I should say, because they're always developing numbers. But it's kind of a bit of a scary picture for theater owners. Prices are up, but attendance is down. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are, of course, blaming the movies because The Mummy, I guess. Geostorm.
Oh.
You know, the chronology that we've been covering on this show.
Yes, well, of course, it's always easy to find one thing to be the answer, because then you just have to fix one thing.
That's right.
When it's a complex problem with complex solutions, that's just too much work, and nobody wants to talk about that. So you're right. It's
great. Let's
of the
wrap
mummy.
Up the show then.
No, it's because of the mummy. Yeah.
But I mean, it's funny how the mummy has sort of been brought up, or even like Transformers, or
as though people didn't also go see Guardians of the Galaxy, Spider-Man: yeah. Homecoming, Wonder Woman, at all the things that I said in our sort of wrap up of the year are the things that just like, could we stop getting so much of these huge blockbusters that were coming out seemingly every single week and bringing in a ton of money.
Right.
So it wasn't I don't believe this lackluster summer blockbuster thing. I'm like, no, there were a ton of blockbusters.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's parse the cuz I mean, you can also say that something like Split was a blockbuster. You can say that
yeah.
Get Out was a blockbuster. It was a blockbuster. Mm-hmm. So there are blockbusters and there are blockbusters, and I think someone made the point that you had a very good like first part of the year where you had the Split, you had Get Out, you had Fate of the Furious, you had Logan. And granted, Logan and Furious are kind of two appendages of long-running successful franchises. Mm-hmm. But I mean, Logan in specific was one that was very different. It was a departure from what had came before. And what it says to me is that, you know, you show the audience something different. They will come, whether it's a brand name or not a brand name. Mm-hmm. Something like Get Out is not a brand name, but it was certainly spoke to a lot of people. Something like the Furious movies were, you know, seen as these dumb. I mean, the first the Fast and the Furious movie mm-hmm. was a ripoff of Point Break.
Yeah, it
and now
was,
it's
wasn't
like
it?
Now it's kind of a ripoff of the Bourne movies. But still, it's, you know, I think what people look for are like these kind of organic blockbusters, and something like the Furious franchise became a franchise quite organically.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I mean, I even said it, I don't remember which episode we were recording, what movie I was seeing, but I talked about...
Not memorable, huh?
Well, no, I saw a lot of movies this summer,
true.
This year in general.
Yeah.
I felt like I was at the movies almost every week, and I talked about how... light the attendance was. You know, I went to go see opening weekend some fairly large movie.
I think that was Transformers.
Well, I definitely saw that also, and I was not surprised that I was the only person in the audience, but I think it was like Guardians of the Galaxy maybe or Wonder Woman, and it wasn't like it was a packed tight audience. There were people there for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, there's so many things that are causing this. You know, movies are coming out for you to watch at home so much faster now.
Yeah.
I think there's just too many theaters, too. Right here in Guelph, there are two big Galaxy cinemas. So that's, what, 10 screens at one and six at the other? So 16 screens. Some of them are playing the same movie. So you have the same movie playing on four different screens across town. So, you know, we're not a huge city. And if every single person in the city wants to go see Star Wars The Last Jedi, they could see it at this, like, seemingly infinite amount of times and theaters.
Yeah.
Right? So you're just splitting up that whole group. And part of the experience of going to a movie theater to see a movie rather than just watching it in the comfort of your own home is actually that group experience. And so the smaller the audience, the less of that experience you're getting. And then it's just like, well, I could just stay home and watch it at home on my couch in, you know, without having to pay the expensive popcorn and pop prices and without having to worry that if I need to go to the bathroom in the middle of this 3-hour movie, because every movie is like 2.5 hours at least now, if I have to go to the bathroom, I'm not going to miss anything. So when you're just taking away one of the actual benefits of seeing a movie at the theater by spreading everybody out, like I'm sure this is happening in other cities too.
Well, sure. I mean, if you go to downtown Toronto, there's, you know, there's Scotiabank, and then a few blocks away, there's Young Dundas. And, I mean, they used to be owned by separate theater companies, but now they're both owned by Cineplex. And and then a few blocks from there, there's Varsity VIP. And then a few blocks from there, there's the Eglinton. So it's definitely that. The other portion of it about home viewing and Netflix and on demand and that kind of thing is valid too. And of course, we Vince and I reviewed a couple of weeks ago Bright, which was Netflix's endeavor to sort of enter blockbuster filmmaking territory. And it seems by and large, regardless of critical and personal feelings about Bright, it did seem to be successful. I think the question is, and people may not realize this yet, but there's still an element of democratization with movie theaters. No matter, I mean, if it is, I mean, not every movie theater gets every movie. You know, certainly smaller movies are disadvantaged. But what happens in a few years when we get like the Disney streaming service and then the inevitable like Warner Brothers streaming service and all these and Sony streaming service, and then it's, you know, where do you get these movies? First of all, where do you get them? Second of all, do you know, when you're crossing borders, who holds the rights? And I think for a lot of people, there's no easy way to get some things on demand or streaming in Canada. And I think there's still, because everything seems so new and so exciting, there's a bit of a learning curve that people have yet to appreciate in terms of, I'm looking for this specific thing, so now where do I go? Do I go to Netflix? Do I go on demand? Do I go to iMovies? Do I go to, can I get it on Prime? Can I, you know, it's going to be tricky, I think, in the future as these things sort of divest and movie studios invest in their own platforms and everything. Meanwhile, like you said, the movie theaters have only ever seemed to learn the lesson of what a lot of business interests have learned, which is just to, that infinite growth is the possibility, rather than maybe going for, I don't know, a different business model. Like, what if they went to one or two screens and focused on, like, I don't know, art house or specialty or revival screenings?
Yeah.
Or, I mean,
well, and to be fair, I know the Galaxy does those Sunday afternoon opera things, and that is packed.
Yeah,
they are packed every time. I went to go see a movie, and it was letting out, and I was like, there's so many people here. This is madness. You know, so there is obviously an appetite for a group experience of something that is a little different from what the theaters are actually offering us right now.
Yeah, and both Peter and I noted when we did the Post last week, we both went to packed packed rooms for the Post. So, you know, obviously, you're not going to set aside like two or three screens for the Post, but I think you know, the Cineplex people have got to look at that, because I can't imagine this is just a Guelph phenomenon that you have to look at. You know, are you kind of maximizing your profits by using your your space well, you know, if you can sacrifice a Star Wars screening for something like The Post, mm-hmm. or something like The Shape of Water, which hasn't played anywhere in Guelph yet even.
Yeah. Though there is so much politics around what films can be shown on what screens,
mm-hmm.
and for how long and all yeah. that sort of stuff. And again, right, it's a complex problem. You can't just blame The Mummy and Geostorm. Or even Transformers.
Well, it's so funny because I was watching on YouTube this morning, Michael Bay's Peter Griffin Gets Fired, where Family Guy did this bit about where it's like, it looks like a Michael Bay movie, but it's pretty hilarious. YouTube that if you can. Michael Bay's Peter Griffin Gets Fired. Moving on to other political realms. I found this interesting, and this may be like incredibly wonkish of me, because how many people are really like sitting around thinking about copyright law, but I did find this article that made a note that as of January the 1st, 2019, mm-hmm. things that were published in 1923 will be in the public domain. And now this is interesting because the United States Congress,
yep.
They who cannot fund their government right now, have voted twice before to extend this. So the copyright used to be 56 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they extended that to 75 in the 70s, and then in the 90s they extended it to 95. But now we're coming up on that sunset, and I did a quick look on the internet about like what films were in the public domain. Well, what films came out in 1923 and then would be in the public domain. So you have like the original Cecil B. DeMille Ten Commandments, mm-hmm. that would be public domain. Another DeMille film, Adam's Rib, The Gold Diggers, Lon Chaney's Hunchback of Notre Dame. That would be in public domain. And then so a lot of music would come in the public domain too. So like the Charleston, which was yeah. the root of the dance craze, the yeah. Charleston. A lot of the original jazz recordings were recorded mm-hmm. in 1923.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is a pretty big deal because for a long time you had, you know, you had almost everybody lined up in favor of holding the copyright forever. Mm-hmm. But in reading this article, what I found interesting was that in the last 20 years, since the last time this was extended, it's come around to the opposite. And now mm-hmm. you have digital forces like Facebook, Google
yeah.
coming, you know, leading the charge and saying, like, these things are supposed to sunset for a reason. These things are supposed mm-hmm. to enter the public domain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, 20 years ago mm-hmm. when Sonny Bono brought the, it's the Sonny Bono Act.
That's right. It was the Sonny Bono Act.
So when he brought it to Congress to extend it, I think in some ways there were valid arguments because many of the artists who were reaping the benefit from those copyrights, those protections, were still alive. And, mm. you know, and I am 100% behind artists getting paid for their work,
mm.
100%. But at the same time, I believe that artists should be paid for their work, and we should remember the artist and the legacy of the artist, but you know, when we start getting into their estates, right, being paid for this, and then it starts to become, and you know, you're a little, I'm equally wonky on copyright law and things like that, but I'm also very, especially now, I feel like I'm becoming more and more, this whole, you know, inequity of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have these people who aren't even reaping the benefits of their own work. The benefits are being reaped and given to people who had literally nothing to do with it. Like, right. You know, I do believe that an artist should be appreciated and should be able to live and create art in their lifetime. And that, sure, they should be able to give their family a good life if they have a family. But eventually, that you can't just hold on to that.
Right.
Especially because, you know, the elephant in the room here, which is really the mouse in the room, is that
yeah.
this is really driven by Disney. Mickey Mouse came out in 1925 and will be, you know, that's the driving force behind
2024.
Behind Steamboat Willie. Bringing this continuously forward
yep.
because the Disney estate doesn't want to lose the license for so many of those things.
Right.
And come on now. Disney spent, what, $4 billion on purchasing Star Wars? And how much more now on purchasing Fox? They have wealth. It's okay. They can...
Disney will be all right.
Yeah. They have other new things under copyright.
Yeah.
Which will continue to make them enormous amounts of money.
You will not see Roy Disney in line at a soup kitchen. It's true.
You probably won't see him on the other side of the soup kitchen serving either. To be fair, I don't know. I don't know.
He might.
But...
I doubt it, but he might.
Yeah.
But you're right. No, that is what's been driven in. It's because, you know, whether it's, you know, Disney with Mickey Mouse or Warner Brothers with Bugs Bunny, I mean, they mm-hmm. use these characters as not just as characters in various products. Mickey Mouse is the mascot. He is the logo. He is mm-hmm. the face of Disney. And it's, you know, I would understand why it would be concerning for Disney to have invested all that into that singular character, why they would not want to lose it. However, I doubt there's going to be, in 2024, when Steamboat mm-hmm. Willie becomes public domain, I highly doubt somebody's like, just waiting for 2024 so I can make my Steamboat Willie remake and really stick it to the mouse. And I doubt that's happening. But at the same time, Disney is also an institution that built its wealth. I mean, it mm-hmm. has tremendous wealth now, but it built its wealth on public domain characters, on Brothers Grimm,
yes.
on Robin Hood, and yeah. you know, Sword and Stone, King Arthur. And of course, Hollywood is enjoying, you know, the benefits of these public domain characters. You know, there was a King Arthur movie that came out last year. Not that
weren't there seven King Arthur movies that came out? Like, I feel like yeah. King Arthur gets remade consistently.
Yeah, no, and the same thing with things
and
like
Holmes,
Sherlock Holmes.
Right? Sherlock Holmes
yeah.
just became...
Sherlock yeah. Holmes, Dracula, that dark universe was all built mm-hmm. on monsters yep. from stories in the 19th century. Who else am I thinking? Robin Hood. I think there's a new Robin Hood that's supposed to come mm-hmm. out this year or next year. That's supposed to lead to a Robin Hood expanded universe. Not joking. But
okay.
Yeah. So look for Friar Tuck the movie in 2023. But I mean that these places that hold their IP so close mm-hmm. are also not afraid to use IP that is in the public domain and into their own ends as well, which yeah. is kind of hypocritical. Well, not kind of, it is hypocritical.
Well, and if you come from sort of a technology world, mm-hmm. the open source has moved technology forward
Absolutely.
So much. And so a lot of people who work in tech feel that there should be fewer you know, IP sort of holdings because you're slowing things down. And so it's similar in art, right? Just like you're saying, these people created art on the backs of something else.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, could you imagine the wealth of art that can be created now with all of these, you know, films and music recordings and characters that people can start working with again? I mean, who knew that in the, you know, late 2000s to early 2010s that teenagers were going to be reading Jane Austen again?
Yeah.
But you throw zombies in there and suddenly it's popular, right? Like, this is actually giving new life to things that are really good. Like, who's, no offense to Mickey Mouse, but how many kids are really into Mickey Mouse nowadays? I don't feel like that's a character that's huge. Even Bugs Bunny, like yeah. our age category, yeah, sure. But I don't think, you know, when the next Space Jam comes out, that's going to introduce Bugs Bunny to a lot of new generations.
I don't think you're wrong. I think, and I do wonder about that. One of my nieces was a big fan of Mickey Mouse because there was a show on like one of the Disney channels mm-hmm. about Mickey Mouse's Clubhouse, and it was all the old gang, Donald and Goofy and Pluto. But you're right. It's I think Mickey has the more value for Disney right now as the logo mm-hmm. because I if you've never seen that Mickey Mouse cartoon, you still know what Mickey Mouse looks like. But
yeah.
I think the more pertinent point from the article was that this is kind of on nobody's radar, mm-hmm. like extending it again. Not even the people driving this. They got comments from the MPAA, which is the movie. Mm-hmm. People in the RIAA, which is music, and it's like, well, that's not on our radar. We're not pushing for it, and certainly Congress is too dysfunctional to pass a budget, let alone look
yeah.
at something as you know, minor as copyright law. So
yeah.
it looks like it may actually, we'll flip the calendar, and as yeah. 1923 stuff will be in the public domain, and would it be interesting to see if, as we kind of tick down to Mickey's turn, mm-hmm. if there'll be some kind of reaction. Okay. So we're going to round out our politics crossover with... you may have heard of this book called Fire and Fury. It is about the Trump White House, and it has received what is supposedly, reportedly, a seven-figure deal to turn it into a TV series. I'm not sure where it will be, but it was a former head of the BBC. I will take that bet. Yeah, the former head of the BBC, Michael Jackson, no relation, is the guy who's kind of got the rights to it. And yeah, no, it definitely won't be on Fox.
Yeah, no, no.
Although, yeah. Although The Simpsons do, I walk up, some of those little shorts they do about mm-hmm. Trump, I feel like walk up to a line where if Groening didn't have certain protections for the last three decades.
Yeah, I'm almost always kind of speechless about American politics.
Yeah.
But I think, this is exactly, as you said, it's exactly the problem with American politics right now, right? It's even the thing that happened with Oprah speaking at the Golden Globes, and suddenly everyone's like, yes, can't she be our president? Like, no, you guys don't understand what there are a number of problems with having Donald Trump as the president, but a really, really big part of it is this whole sort of media cult, this television personality media cult, right? I don't want to sound like a Marxist, but I think Marx had it right when he talked about, it's the opiate of the masses, right? We're just trying to keep people entertained so that people aren't paying attention.
Yeah.
And I think a big part of the problem is that there's a small, vocal revolution happening in America, but it's still, it's way louder than it's ever been, but it's still the same number of people, the same group of people. And, the majority of them are just like, this is hilarious. I don't even have to pay for entertainment anymore. It just happens here. Mm-hmm. And even here in Canada, there are people who are like, oh, it's great. I watch American news all the time. It's so funny. I'm like, this is the problem. This is the problem. It's that we think that it's entertainment and it's not. It's literally our lives.
Yeah. No, you're right. And that's kind of why we try and steer away from the Trump stuff on open sources, is we could talk about it for an hour every week, and it's maddening is what it is. I find it quite maddening. And it's not just Trump himself I find maddening. I find a lot of the media, it was the 1 year anniversary of his inauguration last week, so they're doing a lot of coffee clatches with Trump supporters on CNN and other places, and it's like, oh, so you still love Trump? It's like, yeah, we love Trump. We love this. We love that. And it's like, well, you're not really kind of getting to the meat of the matter. Because I don't want to get into too much of the politics. But one of the things I find this kind of bizarre is Trump because you're right. People watch it as entertainment. So it is basically a TV show already.
Yeah.
And Trump himself treats it as like a TV show. Because he's got his enemies. He's got his rogues gallery of Comey and Hillary Clinton and Obama and the media. So it's like, he thinks he's Batman. And so he's fighting the Joker and the Penguin and the Riddler. He even did in that that cabinet meeting that a lot of people have been giving me praise for my performance. Well, other people call it performance. I call it work. And it's like, no, you call it a performance, too. And he welcomed people into the cabinet room, calling it a studio. So he's kind of keenly aware that he's on a stage. Yeah. This comes from, it does come from his reality show background, but it also comes from the fact that I think Donald Trump was probably born about four decades too early. I think he would have thrived and quite comfortably in a media environment like today if he was like a 20, 30-year-old businessman where you can become popular with your Instagram feed and your Twitter feed. You can become influential and really not have to produce anything. Just slap your name on stuff and endorse things. I think he'd be happy with that.
Yeah.
But he was born in 1946, came of age in the 70s where he had actually produced something to become well-known. And he was almost... I don't want to use the word prescient and Donald Trump in the same sentence, but I mean, in this like very specific regard, he was kind of ahead of the game where he knows the value of promoting self, even to the point of the negative effect on his business interests, which is something we have seen. But yeah, it seems like this is going to feed right into his whatever. You know, that it's, you know, not only
the potential narcissism, right? It's just more people talking about him.
It feeds into the narcissism, but it's also going to feed into the thing like, I got to create content and I got to create the, like this. Mm-hmm. This show is covering me. Now I have to create like the season two storyline. And we can joke about that. But I mean, it does seem very much like how he's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
In the rare moments, it does seem like he's thinking, because he will say one thing and then take it back. But and on top of it all, there's some question about the veracity of some of the details in the Wolf book, too. And
yeah, of course. I mean, I don't understand how you could ever turn this into a TV show, even if it's coming from another country, at the same time that Donald Trump is president.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it's impossible. It's libel. I mean, like, it's just, there's no way around it, right?
Right.
And, you know, and it's potentially... it's potentially dangerous to do it, you know, not only because you're feeding into the this is just entertainment and feeding into the ignorance of people who want to just sit back and laugh, but, you know, you're also potentially inciting the loud, you know, revolt to who knows what.
Yeah. Yeah. The danger is... The danger is that there is a very real thing about conflating the entertainment, especially something that's already entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that they did make Game Change, which was also based on a book about a campaign, and that, but they didn't focus on the president.
Mm-hmm.
They focused on the campaign that didn't win. And even at that, I think... When you look at that, I like the Game Change movie, but I also think it fed into this idea. And Sarah Palin, who's sort of become an also-ran figure, but at the same time, it sort of fed into her sort of media personality, self-obsession. Mm-hmm. About her status. And Sarah Palin is someone who really, in her political career, hasn't produced anything.
Mm-hmm.
She quit halfway through her governorship. Because she basically became a star, and yeah. She didn't need politics anymore in order to, you know, get on TV. She didn't need to actually have to hold a political office, and she had people speculating about her and her political future, even though I don't think she had any interest. And I think that's, you know, basically the same way. The difference is that, of course, Sarah Palin has not actually ever sought political office since. And mm-hmm. I think Donald Trump, we're going to have to take his... to borrow a phrase, cold dead hands off the presidency.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway, let's talk about something peppier.
All right.
We're gonna take a break for some music, and then we're going to review our movie of the week, which is Call Me By Your Name, which is not even Trump related, even though it takes place in the 80s, which was refreshing. And to warm us up, we're going to play a little thing from The Shins called Name For You. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Sounds different. Did you change it?
Well, I changed it a little bit.
Why?
I just played it the way Liszt would have played it if he'd altered Bach's version.
Play that again.
Play what again?
The thing you played outside.
Oh, you want me to play the thing I played outside?
Please.
Ah.
change it again.
Oh, I changed it a little bit.
Yeah, why?
I just played it the way Buzzoni would have played it if he'd altered Liszt's version.
And what is wrong with Bach, the way Bach would have played Bach's
Bach version? Bach never wrote it for the guitar.
And that little musical lesson is brought to you by Call Me By Your Name. It is the new film from, let me see if I can pronounce his name right, Lucia Guadagnino?
Sure.
Yeah, I spelled it. There's a D there, right?
I practiced
this all morning.
Gosh darn it, I can't do it either.
Guadagnino.
Yes.
Guadagnino.
Yeah.
Luca.
And it's Luca.
Guadagnino.
Oh, white Canadians.
We are so white.
Terrible.
It stars Armie Hammer, Timothy Chalamet, and Michael Stuhlbarg. And the screenplay comes from James Ivory. And I wasn't aware of this going in. James Ivory of Merchant Ivory fame. Hmm. Which is, I think when people think of sort of European movies, I think Merchant Ivory comes to mind with the lavish costuming and the classist sort of feel, you know, things like Remains of the Day and Howard's mm-hmm. End and Room with a View. And, you know, here we come this, which I find just so relatable. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm terribly familiar with like lavish Italian vacations.
I know, I was going to say, I think this is also pretty lavish costumes and classist, and it still touches on all of those things, just in a way that we can relate.
It's relatable.
To it.
Yeah. It's relatable. That's the thing. I'm surprised how much I liked it and how light it was. This is mm-hmm. a rare kind of queer romance mm-hmm. story where there's no judgment. There's not a hint of judgment. There's scenes where like they're concerned with how it looks as it's set in 1983. Yeah. But other than that, there's no judgment. There's no parents don't understand BS. It's there's something incredibly pure about it.
Yeah. As I was explaining it to someone yesterday, I said, the enamoring of each of these characters to each other happens in such a way that you could have swapped out mm-hmm. Two gay men for a heterosexual man and woman, and everything would have felt just the same way.
Right.
You know, that it wasn't, there was no like, oh, and it's two men, by the way. And
yes.
It's two men. It's just this really normalized, story of people falling in love. I love the bit that you played, Elio at his most pretentious.
Yes.
but this is actually what works.
Yeah.
This is, as it turns out, being pretentious is exactly the right tack to go for flirting between these two, which just makes me love them even more.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because the Armie Hammer character, Oliver, is introduced in a way that there's a bit of ugly Americanism when he's kind of first introduced, and they joke about how he's like always saying later. It's like, later, what is this?
Later.
And they even incorporated it later, and when he's going off and the parents are just like, okay, later. It's funny. Mm-hmm. But there really is a hint of that the well on this man isn't terribly deep.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn a lot about Oliver kind of seeing him through the eyes of the others, where they're just like, oh, this American beefcake, and like, oh, he's such a handsome guy, and there's really no mention of like, does he have anything interesting to say, does mm-hmm. he have anything interesting to offer. And it's so weird, because I think it gets about halfway through the movie before I was like forced to realize he was kind of there to work.
Yeah. Oh, you didn't sort of get that right away. Yeah. So of course, so the idea is that the man, the father of the family, is a mm-hmm. professor.
Mm-hmm.
His wife owns this villa or whatever in northern Italy. They're kind of a continental sort of family. They live in France. They live in the States. They live in Italy at different times of the year.
They get around.
Yeah. which is one of the things I loved about this, is that it's so completely a quadlingual film.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
There's French, Italian, German,
there's
and
German
English. Yeah. And it's played so well, where people just literally change languages, depending on who they're talking to or what they're saying. And it's so exactly how multilingual people converse. You just change languages so naturally. But yeah, so he's a professor, and presumably, you know, grad students. He has this sort of opportunity where grad students can come and work on their thesis or whatever. And particularly, it looks like he's sort of maybe cultural anthropology, archaeology,
art history.
Yeah. It's kind of we're not entirely sure.
No.
We don't ever really find out, but yeah. So I did actually sort of pick up on that fairly quickly.
I got the understanding he was kind of there on a work study, but you don't really see anybody work until about halfway through.
But come on now. It's Northern Italy in the middle of the summer. And
yes.
I think this is one of the things that there are so many things I really liked about this film. But one of the things I really liked is it just like it was just so lush and beautiful and coloring and just the moments of laying there in the sun with nothing to do. I'm like, you know what? I feel right now as though I'm there. Like the whole film just played out so languidly as though you were, you know, summering in this intense heat in Italy. Right? And they go into town at certain times and there's just not a soul that you can see because it's the middle of the afternoon and it's probably blisteringly hot.
Yeah.
So everybody is inside.
Yeah, and this is something that Guadagnino nailed it.
Good one.
Does good. His last film, I think it was called A Bigger Splash, but it's like kind of the same area, but the look of the film is very much the same, where it's like the outside scenes are just like sun-drenched, or it's like this kind of like yellow filter that makes you feel the heat and makes feel the warmth of the countryside, of course, very lavishly photographed as well. So he kind of slides right into the Merchant Ivory mold, because everywhere you go in this film, you're like, I gotta go there.
Right. And so let's talk about the actual filming for a bit minute, because this was done on film, 35mm.
Mm-hmm.
And it, yeah, as you say, it's beautiful. I mean, how could you not? Like, you're in Italy, like, use the landscape.
Yeah.
But I've got to say, the focus puller on this film is a hero. I think that probably was the hardest working person on set, because the cinematographer, whose name I absolutely cannot pronounce, and I've never seen any films done by him before, but it feels like every scene your eyes were supposed to be at a certain place, and the focus puller's job is actually to, you know, as you're moving around the camera, to make sure that the right things stay in focus. And there were so many times that, you know, there were things that were coming in and out of focus, and my eyes knew exactly where to go all the time. And there was a lot of story told by moving the camera. You know, again, right, just the romance, the two of them sort of falling in love, and the visually eating each other up.
Yeah.
Right? Which I was like, I see that. I have never had much care for Armie Hammer. I sort of thought the actor who plays Oliver, I've always just sort of assumed he was kind of a big, dumb, blonde jock guy. I mean, he played the Winklevoss twins.
He was the Winklevi.
In Social Network, the Winklevi. And the Lone Ranger, right? Like, great job, Armie Hammer. But this film, like, it just, like, how did you turn this person to just this beautiful, like, everything about him you just wanted? I just felt like I was eating him up, because it was just so well filmed.
Right. I'll give Armie Hammer a break. I don't think the Lone Ranger was his fault. but you're right. He's a very bland sort of square-jawed American guy. And that has not been used to its fullest. Interestingly, I think he kind of went away after the Lone Ranger, but he's kind of come back in the last few years. He was in Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I thought he was good in. He was good playing the straight man against Henry Cavill as the Russian agent. And he was in Free Fire, which was this basically like hour and a half it was a Mexican standoff movie, which had a lot of great actors in it. And he was up to the challenge there. So I hope this is an indication he's maybe being a bit choosier in his roles. And this was... you praised the clip, but I will take a mulligan on that, because that's really the only clip with like really something audio to listen to, because we are a radio show.
Yeah.
But it's so much of the romance part of it is told through body language and through the point of view shots and seeing how Elio reacts to watching him dance with one of the girls at the disco, and seeing him, Elio go into, Oliver is staying in his room, so Elio's going into his room and sort of, you know, examining Oliver's, you know, clothes, and it's, you know, even Elio and Timothée Chalamet, who I'd never heard of before, is so great because he throws in these little, you know, little dance moves as he's walking along, and which is it's kind of a very teenager thing to do to sort of explore the space and let, you know, let your body do the talking. And it's just, so much of this is just visual, and it makes it universal in a way, because, yes, it's very multilingual, and it flows very well, and all you're listening to dialogue, reading subtitles and all that, but so much of it is just universally told through the body language.
Yes, and looks, too, right? Because even the mother, so, of course, you were saying that it's this queer love story with no judgment, and so these two boys, men, so we can talk about the age difference. Armie Hammer's character is presumably like a grad student, roughly probably 23, 24, and Elio is supposed to be 17. Of course, the actors are a little bit older than that, so you have to suspend a little disbelief.
Especially in the case of Armie Hammer, I don't think he's 23.
It was really difficult, especially considering so Michael Stuhlbarg, who plays the father, is only like 10 years older than Armie Hammer. Like, there's a lot of, but you know, it is a film, and we are expected to walk in with sort of a blank slate and to believe what is told to us. You know, but
the Riverdale kids graduated high school a long time ago.
But yeah, so the mother, I mean, as you're watching it, you can tell she knows immediately that there's an attraction, like immediately, right? From that first moment when Armie Hammer's drinking that apricot juice.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I didn't expect that to make me feel quite so enamored of Armie Hammer, but wow, who knew you could drink a glass of apple or apricot juice that well? But immediately you could see that, you know, she knew that her son was watching him and taking that all in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, never is it actually said, but you can tell the whole time that she's just like,
I'm glad you picked up on that, because there's a scene near the end where Elio is talking to his father, and his father's basically saying, like, I'm glad that you guys had this really great friendship. Of course, friendship is in asterisks, because he knows.
It's just the word that you use.
Right, but he's talking about how he never had anything like that. So at least it's like dangling question, like, is the father also living this, where he was gay or had gay feelings, but, you know, did the heteronormative thing and settled down and married. And Elio asks, does mother know?
Yeah.
And a lot of people like are reading that like, does the mother know about he had this relationship with Oliver? I read that as, does the mother know that his father also had a similar experience with, you know, his Oliver maybe back when he was a grad student or as a young man? Because, it was so obvious to me the mother knew.
Oh, yeah, she knew, absolutely. And what's interesting, of course, because I also read the father saying, I never had that. And then there's the line, you had such a deep relationship because it was him, because it was me, he said, right? So he sort of took himself even out of talking to his son and was remembering his own sort of thing. But there is a scene where him and Armie Hammer, Oliver, are looking through slides together of these sculptures. And there's a look that Armie Hammer gives because they're talking about this, the male form and how sensual all these statues are, which they were, again, even the statues, like, where do they even find these? Like, I'm not even...
And there's a line, there's nothing straight here. That's an actual line. There's nothing straight.
Yeah. But so, you know, and the father is sort of, he's going through the slides and describing like the sensuality and the form and all of this sort of thing. And Oliver looks at him with a look. Yeah. And, you know, it is sort of the, oh, so you're seeing the same thing I'm seeing when I'm looking at this male form. And he seemed really surprised when he looked at him. And mm-hmm. I do, and it's not to discount the relationship that the father and the mother had, because they were complete partners.
Sure.
Complete partners in a way that transcends, I think, just a sexual intimacy. They were, you know, best friends. They were intellectuals. They were, you know, they were together on all of the, which I think, again, is one of those things that's just like romance and love and choosing who you're going to be with is about so much more than the gender and or sex of the other person.
Right. And that there's that undercurrent through the whole thing, the kind of fluidity of discovering yourself and coming to understand your sexuality, because of course Oliver and Elio both pursue and are pursued by women in the film too. And there's a very, it's not, you don't see it sort of explicitly with Oliver. I can't remember the young woman's name, but Marzia and Elio, they actually have sex. They have sex twice, and they have sex the afternoon before he has sex with Oliver for the first time. And, you know, there's never a moment where you're like, well, he just had sex with a girl.
Well, no, and even because presumably, I mean, he even says, right, I can't believe how good that felt.
Yeah.
And it surprises him.
Right.
But, you know, again, the fluidity, right? Like, it's just physical is, humans are just physical beings. And in general, any sort of physical intimacy does feel good. But again, there's so much more to who you want to be with and who you love. And there's the mind and body thing. And I do really love that relationship between him and Marzia, because she also knew, right?
Yeah.
She knew right from the beginning. And she even said, you know, I'm nervous around you because, and I don't act like myself because I don't want to be hurt.
That's right.
And she knew, but yet she decided, because she's also just, you know, a 17-year-old girl and discovering herself and you know, all these things. And hello, it's this beautiful Northern Italian. Like, when else are you going to hook up with the guy you really have a crush on? Like,
that's right.
Just do it. And so she did. She chose to, despite the fact that she kind of knew that he wasn't, that they weren't on the same place. They just weren't in the same place. And she wasn't surprised when she went to go see him. Like, she didn't have to ask why, you know, she said, am I your girl?
Right.
He gave no response. And she said, I know. I mean, I didn't need to even ask the question. I know.
Right.
I know the answer.
And then they meet after, like, near the end of the film. And it's like, there's an understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, although she leaves, that she's obviously upset, but I mean, it's probably one of those things that occurred to her while he was gone with the handsome older guy as well. And it's really fascinating, because it does play into that the poem, the German poem that the mother reads about, you know, is it better to speak or to die,
and
the choice everybody makes, whether it is Marzia, whether it's Elio, whether it's Oliver, is like, it is better to speak, you know, no matter what happens. And that of course leads into the father's monologue, which is Michael Stuhlbarg in that scene. Like, there's nothing flashy about it. It's just him talking, and
it tore me apart. That, you know, like, there were certainly many lovely moments, many moments that were heartbreaking, but his speech was the thing that brought me to tears.
It
was so moving,
and you don't expect it to, but it just says it kind of goes on, and he just keeps talking, and he says, you know, it's rare to find these things, and he tells Elio to, like, you know, people will tell you to just, like, break off that pain, but, you know, the more you break off of yourself, the less you have to offer to the next person.
And that line about, you know, we do this and then we go bankrupt by the time of 30.
Yeah.
Right. I'm like, oh, you know, it's one of those things where certainly I'm kind of a person who tries to sort of maintain a certain control over my emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, watching this, it's just like, right, this is a lesson that I could stand to learn maybe a little bit more. I'm sure we all could.
Yeah.
It was,
But, and that plays into the end, and the credits roll as he's kind of staring into the fire. He learns that Oliver is moving on, and so you see this kind of wash over his face, the you know, the pain and the regret and the sadness, and but then you slowly kind of see the realization of what the father was getting mm-hmm. at. It's like, you know, you don't break off those parts of yourself, yeah. even though there were some bad things. There were also a lot of good things. Mm-hmm. And you see, you sort of slowly see that realization, and it kind of cuts before he kind of outright smiles.
Yeah, but pain has moved from his face, and he has moved into nostalgia or bittersweet memories, right? He's moved a little bit, not into happiness, but into, the gift of all the rest of it. And honestly, you're right. You know, Timothée Chalamet, his acting in this was so good, so good. And despite the fact that he's he's a few years older than the 17 that mm-hmm. he was supposed to be playing, he felt like a teenager, yeah. right? That, as you were saying, the dancing, that exuberance, that, that reserved sort of thing. And then suddenly this burst of like manic body energy,
yeah.
right? That's just because that's the thing, you know, it's like, what do I do with all this energy that I've got all of a sudden? And so this youthful exuberance.
And also playing it like hot and cold and mm-hmm. like, you know, he'll be like cool and distant at one point, and then he'll be like the center of the crowd in another. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not unusual for teenagers to be on one end yeah. of the dial or the other. And yeah, there's something so very naturalistic about mm-hmm. it, this performance. It's, yeah, of course he's an older person, but yeah. He sold the teenageness of it, which yeah. was, you know, exactly what it needed. Because if the chemistry between the two of them didn't work, mm-hmm. then the movie doesn't work, because it is yeah. all about them, and like any romance, which yeah. we come back to. And you mentioned the male form. There's a lot of male form in this, mm-hmm. which I found interesting. And again, it plays into this the whole thing about heteronormatives, because it would not, mm-hmm. even though we like to think ourselves a bit more progressive now, and we like to think that, you know, Hollywood, liberal bastion, mm-hmm. seeing men in an afterglow after making love mm-hmm. to men is still somewhere that Hollywood doesn't want to go.
Yeah.
And this movie leaned into that, mm-hmm. Which was appreciated, because, you know, you can see something like Blue is the Warmest Color, which can be as explicit as it wants to be about two women. But if you see two men making love, that is still taboo.
Yeah.
And what I appreciate is that it broke down that barrier mm-hmm. to an extent. Not as much as I think probably the director would have liked from some of the reading I did.
Yeah, but... well, and which is interesting, because some people talk about that choice, which of course is, to pan over, like out the window.
Right.
As the actual act is happening. Which I think, you know, there's a lot there. One of them being literally the comfort of the actors. I mean, I think of this anytime I see a sex scene, I'm just mm-hmm. like, this just seems like it would be so awkward and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, sex at the best of times is sometimes awkward and uncomfortable. You're like, wait, where, how, do, what goes where? Hold
yeah,
on.
That's right.
My leg, ow. Right. And so so it's already a challenging thing mm-hmm. to film. So I think, you know, just from the point of view of the actors having to do it, you know, I can appreciate that we don't need to actually see it. We understand what is happening. There is right. no need to see it or to make it salacious or to make it, you right. know, even taboo, right? Because we do come back and we definitely see, just as you say, the afterglow of
yeah.
it. But one person I read was writing about it, saying that what's so important there is, because as we talked about, you know, all the lush visuals, and all eyes are on these two men the whole time, including ours, and to give them that one moment of privacy when, you know, they're going to be at their most vulnerable, they're going to be at their most intimate with each other, and to actually let them have that intimacy. I was like, well, that's an interesting idea mm-hmm. to do that.
Yeah, I would agree. But still, it's... despite breaking new barriers, I think it's a very great movie mm-hmm. in terms of it, just as a character piece, yep. as a travelogue of the wonders of Italy.
Yeah, and 1983 too. I mean, there's so much good. There's the beautiful, like just the lushness of it, the time and place, the 1983, the soundtrack. Sufjan Stevens has two songs mm-hmm. that are really fairly important, actually, to the actual film too, and they're just, it's just great. Everything, I'm totally I'm totally enamored with this film. I really, really enjoyed it.
And I think it's at the bookshelf for a little while longer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, go and check it out if you want. And we highly encourage you to do so. And that is it for End Credits this week. You can find us at endcreditsradioshow.com, or you can find other episodes of the show. And we are on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook, End Credits Radio on the Twitters. And Candace, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on the internet at Cinn48, that's C-I-N-N-4-8. And you can also hear a little bit more about The Bookshelf on our podcast, which is The Village Podcast from The Bookshelf.
Excellent. And I will be back here later today on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. You can find us there at 5 p.m. You can find me on the internet at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter and Instagram, or you can go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on the CFRU channel, CFRU.ca, CFRU 93.3 FM, Campus Community Radio in Guelph, and we'll be back here next Thursday at 10 a.m. for more End Credits, and we'll see you then.